listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I'm Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at University of Toronto and Yale University. And you are Bob Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter. And this is the Non-Zero podcast. That's true.
And you, in addition to being a famous psychologist and writer, are publisher of the, did you say this? You're publisher of the Falsely Modest newsletter, Small Potatoes. Did you remember to say that?
I did not remember to say that.
You know, Paul, I have a vision I'd like to share with you.
I'm all ears.
So, you know, as I get older, in some respects, my hopes about what legacy I might leave this planet are shrinking, becoming more modest. Like, I would say the chances that I would bring salvation to all of humankind, I would say now are under 30%. But there's something I still hope to accomplish. And you know what that is?
Help promote small potatoes.
It's related to that. I hope to create a world in which, and tell me if this is too idealistic, a world in which everyone who thinks of the newsletter Small Potatoes thinks of the phrase falsely modest, much as in the 1980s when you were a wee lad, thanks to the editors of Spy Magazine, many, many New Yorkers could not think of Donald Trump without thinking of the phrase short-fingered vulgarian, because every time they wrote about Trump, the first reference, Donald Trump, was preceded by the phrase short-fingered vulgarian. And I would like to do something similar for your newsletter.
I would appreciate that. And something we spoke about a little while before, but a phrase hiking the Adirondack Trail, which for me will never lose this amusing connotation.
No, although we would like to get to the point where you call it the Appalachian Trail, because that's what that's what it is. We alternate between you calling it the Adirondack and then in the next episode apologizing, but this time you for mischaracterizing, for misnaming it. This time you can apologize now. Go ahead.
I am sorry. But this could get corrected. We could just kind of retape this whole part, lose 30 seconds, and I don't look bad.
No, the spontaneity is priceless. This is what the people are paying for. People who are paying, and nobody's actually paying for this part of it.
I was on another podcast, and I kept referring to, we were talking about the mechanics of making money off podcasts, and I was very new to this, and I kept referring to Sam Tunding, to Patreon, not as Patreon, but something like a trueness or something. And for the longest time, I think they understood what I was saying, and then they just kind of played along. And then later in the podcast, they gave up and said, Paul, it's actually pronounced Patreon.
Well, I don't play along. You'll be hearing from me upon first mischaracterization. What podcast was that?
It may have been my friend's Very Bad Wizard.
May have been. We could ask them. So
there's also another story of Very Bad Wizards, which reflects badly on me, but well on them, where I had a very nice microphone, which I was very proud of. And I waved and I showed them it's expensive. And I whispered into it and I made them do sound checks. And they said, it doesn't quite seem to work. And I said, this is an excellent microphone. And at the end of the podcast, I'm telling them about it and I'm reaching up to show it to them. And I realized the wires connect to nowhere. I have not plugged it into my computer.
Yeah. Well, this is why your podcast career hasn't yet taken off. The other reason being that you don't yet have a podcast of your own.
No.
But you're getting there. You're getting there.
It's so much easier being the interview than being the guest.
Well, it depends. Yeah. If you're someone who's not curious about other human beings because you don't care about them at all, sure. If you wrote a book called Against Empathy, for example, and so which means you don't care about human beings, then naturally you would not enjoy asking them to share their inner lives with you.
I'm not denying that. Part of my reluctance to get a podcast is because of my indifference and sometimes hatred of other human beings. Uh-huh. That deserves a good reason. But also the editing, the scheduling, the
see, this the, is, listen, you know, don't
rivers,
let...
Riverside and whatever.
This gets to what a bad influence the people of Very Bad Wizards can be on a person. They edit. Don't listen to them. Don't edit.
Don't edit.
Yeah. Big time saver.
Well, I'll say in praise of your non-edited podcast, I listened to your discussion with Reid Hoffman. I thought it was very good.
Yeah.
An interesting clash of views about AI.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, Reed's more optimistic than I am, as well he should be. He co-founded this company, Inflection, which puts out this very interesting AI bot, PI, which people should check out. And he was on the board of OpenAI, pre-drama. He left the board to start Inflection and missed out on the soap opera. But yeah, I encourage people to check that out. He talks about OpenAI and a lot of stuff. And you're getting interested in AI, which I like.
I am.
For example, well, before we get into this, well, let's decide whether we're going to get into things. I maintain that there may, even as we speak, be a news flash about the lab leak hypothesis. Okay? You seem less interested, but at some point I want to get to that. I think there may be a news flash that
I'm willing to patiently
increase our estimate of the chances that there was a lab leak. And then, well, there's the Casey Newton, very big Substack newsletter, leaving Substack because of what he says is the Nazi problem. I want to talk about that.
Someone else wrote the article, the big Atlantic article, that Substack has a Nazi problem.
That started this.
Yeah.
And you're still going with Nazi, apparently, as the pronunciation, which is closer to Nazi than Adirondack is to Appalachia, and is acceptable. I should say there are people who say that. There are people, and there are people who say Nazi, right? There's Nazi, Nazi, and Nazi.
Yeah. You know, you've simply restructured a podcast to make these episodes sort of a problem speech therapy discussions where you kind of work with me. And it's just, and we change the music to make it nice and soft, and we talk about it. And it could speak to a whole different audience.
I frankly am still looking for the niche where I can thrive, and maybe you've hit on it.
I tell people it's from, whenever I mess up the pronunciation, I tell people it's from my background, being raised in Montreal, part of Canadian accent, probably from Quebec and so on. The problem is it doesn't work when I bump into people from my very neighborhood. Uh-huh. They say, well, we don't talk like that. We talk normal.
Yeah, well.
But anyway, Nazi.
Yeah.
Nazi?
You don't have to keep saying it, but yeah.
Okay. It's just endless.
Talk about a word where once is enough.
Yeah.
So
I was talking to a friend of mine, by the way, and this is something to get into, is how did Hitler get so bad relative to, say, Stalin, Mao?
I think he started out crazier.
Is it craziness?
Yeah, well, he grew up full of hatred in a way that, I mean, I'm sure Mao had his class resentments. Mm-hmm. You know, Hitler grew up in Vienna, poor, resenting more affluent and more, and Vienna was a very cosmopolitan place, right? Yeah. That's one reason it was such a center of intellectual achievement in the late 19th century, you know, ideas from all over flowing in, people getting together. And he chose to apparently resent affluent Jewish cosmopolitans in particular.
Yeah.
And I don't know much about Stalin and Mao, but, you know, class resentment in a way is a less, it seems like the upper limit on the toxicity is a little lower than ethnic and, you know, class plus ethnic.
One way to put it is Hitler is the sort of paradigmatic racist, and racism is the ultimate sin. So he gets pushed up as the most evil person in the world. Stalin.
Oh, wait, he did also do like the most evil thing, you know, I mean, the most systematic, large scale, intentional atrocity in the history of the planet.
Stalin killed more, but in some way it was less intentional.
I think there's even, I don't know my Stalin, yeah. But I think there's some question as to like, to what extent was the famine, you know, to the famine part of it, was that side effect of collectivization? I don't know. I've already said something incorrect, I'm sure, but I don't know. But,
one way to take it is that it doesn't have to do so much with the properties of these men, but the properties of the politics around at the time. Where Hitler was a fascist, and nobody, no right-thinking person supported Hitler's fascism pretty soon in America. But Stalin was a communist, and there was a long intellectual history where a lot of left people were defending Stalin. And it turned fairly late when they say, well, maybe he's gone a little bit too far.
True. I mean, there were people in America accused of being more sympathetic than we might have liked. I mean, Lindbergh being a classic case of, you know, I don't know that part either. I do know there's a place not all that far from where I live called Lindbergh Road. It's called that because he lived, it's the house where his kid was kidnapped, the whole, that story.
Yeah.
Anyway, there is an intersection of Lindbergh Road and Zion Road. For the record, as the laying out of roads in New Jersey would have it, that is the case.
Huh.
Just thought I'd say that. It struck me as kind of ironic when I saw it. But we digress. Apparently, you would like us to talk about the Substack thing first. So you've been kind of steering us in the Nazi, as you say, direct.
No, you don't have to do it. Don't patronize me. Use the same.
Okay.
I'll go wherever you want. Gladly.
We'll get back to Substack.
That I don't mind.
I mean, you and I are on Substack.
Yeah. Right? We're staying on Substack.
We're staying on Substack. We should say that.
I mean, I have read different discussions of the whole Substack thing, and for the most part, anti-censorship. And I think that, yeah, it's going to have some ugly characters up there. And I'm not an absolutist in some way. You know, I think I can imagine cases where if it turns out to be nothing but a hotbed of anti-Semites and QAnon or whatever, I say, I don't want to be there anymore. But I actually think that the cost of any good, vibrant, free community is that there's some people there who are utter assholes who say terrible things.
You can say shit on this podcast. They say terrible shit.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, but and I just remembered that in your last podcast with Reid Hoffman. All of a sudden, said that's really fucked up.
Did I say that?
No, he did. Sounded like someone moved it up.
I'm so disappointed.
You can do this podcast that way.
Yeah, if he can say it, right? Because he's more respectable than we are.
But anyway, there are fucked up people on Substack. And I don't necessarily view that as a problem with Substack. I don't think that they necessarily have to. The problem is once you start rooting them out, you have to make some judgment calls. And then when you make those judgment calls, you end up kicking out people who say, for instance, that maybe there was a lab leak.
Oh, that was an excellent segue.
Yeah, hey.
I want to get back to Substack because I'm probably less of a free speech absolutist than you are.
Yeah.
And in fact, one reason I'm not leaving Substack is it seems like it'd be a pain in the ass to leave a platform as part of my calculus. But just quickly on the lab leak thing. So Matt Ridley, who is a friend of mine, I should say, you know, kind of conservative, now member of the House of Lords.
I just know that from the Beatles song.
They mentioned Ridley?
No. There's some line about the House of Lords.
Oh, you know that's why you know there is a House of Lords?
Yeah.
Not a tribute to the Canadian educational system, but whatever. We all learn things in different ways.
Right.
So there is a House of Lords. Matt Ridley is part of it, but he's also, he did graduate work in biology, journalist, and so on. And he wrote a book about lab leak. I forget the name, but he tweeted this morning, game over, the latest revelations provide precise confirmation that all the many suspicious features of SARS-CoV-2, which imply it was man-made, were set out in exhaustive detail in the diffuse proposal to which Wuhan Institute of Virology was a partner. Now, this is the proposal. I'm not sure what diffuse stands for. I can find out. But I think the EcoHealth Alliance was one of the, I think technically British-based, although I think run by an American. I'm not sure. Anyway, or it's maybe it's the other way around. But anyway, the EcoHealth Alliance was... partner to this grant. And of course, the basic idea is that we now know, we didn't know this at the time, but there had been a proposal from some American researchers and the Wuhan lab together to do research on a virus that would have led to something very much like what COVID became. Yeah. Gain of function research. It was a proposal to like the DARPA, I guess, at the Pentagon or something. It was turned down. Now, the research was going to be done in America, but it was in collaboration with Wuhan. EcoHealth Alliance was involved. I'm going to nail that down completely as we speak to make sure I don't get sued. But I forget the particular snippet they were talking about inserting, but it turned out to be kind of what the virus wound up with. Anyway, Matt is now saying that we have more details about their plans, and he knows this better than I do. He knows the biology much better. That just nail it down. And What's interesting to me is, like, I wonder whether even if that's true, we will read about it in the New York Times, which you would think we should if it's true, right? But will we?
I think there's been a structural shift. And so the answer might be yes in the case, and it wouldn't have been no a few months ago, where lab leak is gradually rising, even in sort of normies' ideas, people who aren't obsessed with this. That's just, it's no longer crackpot. It's a possible idea. And I don't have a dog in a fight. I honestly have no strong opinion either way, except to know that smart people I respect are arguing both positions. And it no longer seems tenable, as it once was, to view the lab leak as kind of a racist, insane hypothesis. It's very much on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think reading this, is there a distinction between the idea that it got out of a lab inadvertently, which is awful, but mandates a certain sort of response, like, hey, everybody be more careful from here on in.
Right.
Or that there was some idea of intention.
Well, there's a distinction, and I don't think there's any chance that it was intentional. I mean, you know, you don't release these things in your own country on purpose if you're a government, right? I mean, that the idea that it was some kind of intentional bioweapons thing is nuts.
And, so we can still put that in the crackpot theory.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, but it's still, but this thing worries me. It's like, I'm not, on the one hand, I'm ambivalent, because I do think the world's attention needs to be drawn to the urgent necessity of building a system of international regulation that makes it not only harder for this to happen, the inadvertent release from a major lab, and possibly discourages gain of function research generally, but also to make it harder for bad actors in some not so famous lab to develop something and release it intentionally. I mean, we are just so far behind the curve on the level of threat. Nobody's talking about it. And you know, what you're going to hear as a result of this, and this is why I'm, you know, at best ambivalent about this turning out to be true, if it's true, is that you're going to hear, you know, your Trump is saying, right, China is evil, further disengagement, deeper Cold War, when that's actually the opposite of what you need if you actually want to address the problem I've just described. You know, you need to be on sufficiently good terms with all nations to set up an actual global policing system, which I think China would in principle be okay with if we were on better terms with them.
This has to be framed as malevolent or one country imposing upon another country. There's a nice way of putting it, saying, boy, it looks like it slipped out of one of your labs. This is nobody's interest. So let's all work together as a community of nations to make sure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, China has dug in on its position. I mean, not shockingly, perhaps, it wasn't eager to become known as the country that started the pandemic through sloppiness or whatever. And so, you know, they seem ill-inclined to admit that this is the case if it is.
Doesn't everybody believe it came from China?
Everybody believes it came from China, but not everybody believes it was a lab leak.
Yeah.
I mean, if it just came from China because they happen to have the kind of bats, right?
Yeah.
That's one thing. But if they fucked up, that's another thing.
Yeah, it's more responsibility.
And of course, the fact that they're not leveling with us, if that's the case, if that turns out to be the case, is, you know, only deepens, you know, the intensifies the arguments of kind of the right wing nationalists who are like, see, they're hiding something. They want to kill us all. And so we should disengage and further increase the chances that they will kill us all, whatever. So
this isn't an attempt to bring together conversations, but the idea that we could have a protocol in place that goes into laboratories capable of creating these deadly viruses is at least analogical to the idea that we could have a sort of planet-wide protocol that says this about generative AI.
Well, it's the same kind of challenge. It's interesting. There's a good book on AI called The Coming Wave, I think, by Mustafa Suleiman, who is one of Reid Hoffman's, Reid Hoffman's co-founder of Inflection. He was also a co-founder of DeepMind, which is now Google's AI operation, basically. And his book emphasizes the biotechnology threat, both because AI could accelerate the threat, but also because I think he's right that it's a not bad analogy for the challenge of regulation. AI is more like, it's more like regulating biotech, which is to say very, very hard, than it is like regulating nuclear weapons, because they're so big and conspicuous and capital intensive and so few people, you know, it's harder to acquire the knowledge you need to make them and the materials. So I think these are two reasons we can't afford like a big Cold War, and we need to get, for that matter, the hot war kinds of conflicts under control and start solving actual problems. Yes. I actually wrote this piece in the Washington Post months and months ago that AI should have an effect on our basic thinking about foreign policy. And as you may have noticed, the world has come around to my way of thinking, and American foreign policy has been transformed. We're not supporting conflicts anywhere.
I don't think you persuaded. You've done a good persuasion job at foreign policy. But other aspects.
Yeah. It's kind of like, it's related to the salvation of all humankind thing. But your newsletter, that's a realistic target. That I can do. The falsely modest.
Yeah, you know, if you could somehow promote the newsletter, just because of the effects of the newsletter, you could be doing a huge amount.
All publicity is good publicity, right?
I once invited Peter Singer to give a talk on a class I was giving at Yale. Peter Singer was a good friend of yours. On morality. And he says, as a guest speaker, you're talking about different issues. He said, reasonably enough, I'm an extremely busy guy. Nice guy, very busy guy. So you have to pay me a fair sum of money. Hmm. And I'll give the money to charities, which make a whole lot of
good. That's nice.
And I said to him, you're thinking about it in a small way. I said nicely. But you see, if you come to talk and you persuade the 300 Yale students in my class on the wisdom of giving money to the poor and everything, that effect you will get will be far greater than any money I would give you. And he was not convinced. He was not convinced. I think maybe he legitimately enough thought that there's more of an uncertainty how his words are going to catalyze specific actions.
Well, maybe this was the beginning of the earn to give concept that Sam Bankman-Fried eventually adopted to uneven effect, I would say.
Had an uneven effect.
He's had an uneven career.
I mean, one thing you and I think disagree about, we kind of often talk around, is I'm much more sympathetic to the rationalists in general and effective altruists more specifically. And in a defense, and they've been very defensive since Sam Bankman-Fried, who was by no means good publicity for their movement, that the EAs have done a lot of good.
These are effective altruists for
effective
people.
Altruists who just those nerds who kind of add up and figure out where could our money go to the best place regarding malaria relief, regarding experiments where people get incomes and see how they improve their life, and discouraging gain of function research with COVID viruses. They have an excellent record. Mm-hmm. And if you take it at the whole, Sam Bankman-Fried is definitely a black mark. He is a guy who has used that philosophy for bad. But for the most part, they're doing pretty well.
Yeah, I actually have recorded a podcast that hasn't run yet. We'll run within the next couple of weeks with Rob Wiblin. Do you know the 80,000 Hours podcast? It's the kind of, it's related to the Center for Effective Altruism, which is the big thing. And he kindly agreed to come on and talk about the whole public relations challenges emanating from Sam Bankman-Fried, public relations challenges for EA. But you're right. I think, I mean, the podcast, go look at the 80,000 Hours podcast. I think they're doing God's work in terms of the issues they're illuminating. It was a good conversation.
I mean, in general, I think the rationalists are the good guys. I think they're good guys in two ways. One is that they regularly produce things that are good by anybody's account. I have a friend and a student, Vlad Chidduck, and this is public that he's talking about, but he, and moved by work by Peter Singer and Will McCaskill and so on, he donated a kidney to a stranger.
Wow.
And that's just a nice thing to do.
Yeah, and I can't quite get there, you know?
Yeah. What's stopping you?
The thought of having only one kidney. I mean, I mean, first of all, are they really sure that one kidney's as good as two? It's like they used to say, sure, go ahead, remove your spleen. And I think now there are doubts about whether the spleen really has no function. What are the chances that an organ would have no function?
Scott Alexander and Astral Codex has a long discussion of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, in his style, he says, fine, you have 400 pages on this point. I guess I'll agree with you. But nonetheless, he does say that one kidney is as good as two.
But however, still, there is the risk of suppose something happens to it, right?
Yes. And it's also a risk of what if a family member needs one?
Now you're right. Well, but that...
And they have mechanisms for that, which is that once you give a kidney, mm-hmm. any family member of yours gets on top of the line for a new kidney.
But if you're a strict utilitarian... Family members don't get preference over non-family members, although very few utilitarians actually act like that. Now, you mentioned you just said something that almost implied that rationalists and effective altruists are the same. And one thing that we talked about in my conversation with Rob is that, like, there are a lot of misconceptions about EAs. Mm-hmm. And one of them, I mean, I said this and I think he agreed, is that it's the same as rationalists. Like, there's overlap. There's overlap. But the rationalists have some quirks that I'm not sure you would say are part of EAs. And then similarly, some things are attributed to them that might not, that aren't true of all rationalists or all people who call themselves rationalists. It's a funny thing. I mean, one of them being a polyamory, right? I mean, and I've heard it. Since the other big thing that's happened with EA is involvement in the OpenAI drama, because a couple of people on the board were said to be EA affiliated and very concerned about AI risk. And that's why they wanted, one reason maybe they wanted Altman off the board. Where was I going with this? This is a test.
We're talking about defective altruists and rationalists. And your point,
I can save myself. I appreciate the offer. I can save myself here. I was going to say, in some of the coverage of that, it was asserted, I think maybe even it was asserted, like, effective altruists are into polyamory. And that was like, you know, stereotyped by association. It was like, well, no, we say that about rationalists, and some of them are. But anyway.
I actually see myself. I don't know if I'm a member of either group. I've never filled out a form or something. But I think I'm very much in favor of effective altruism.
Mm-hmm.
Effective altruism seems in the simplest form, like evidence-based medicine, where it's weird that there'd be a view against it. I mean, effectively, it's this idea you should direct your kindness and your goodness where it will make the most difference.
Well, that was the beginning version. Two things happened. One was the idea of earn to give, which led to Sam Bankman-Fried. But then the other was long-termism.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, Peter's kind of long-term skeptical. I mean, he's not a big long-termist, I think.
Peter Singer, yes.
Yeah.
Especially skeptical.
But long-termism is the idea that you know, you in the grand utilitarian calculus, you should consider all generations to come.
Yeah.
Which means that any existential threat, truly existential threat, that could end the human experience, even if there's a very, very, very low probability of it happening, it still carries great weight, and you should spend great resources to further reduce the chances of it happening once you do the math. There are a lot of problems with this, but originally, this wasn't really at all a prominent part of EA, and it came more to be, and that's why they got so big into the AI risk thing.
Yeah.
As a result of the long-termist dimension.
No, that's fair enough. I see myself as a long-termist, but in a light sense. So I think we should worry about things and about things that will affect us long after you and I are dead, or even after our children are dead. Mm-hmm. Things like, you know, asteroid impacts, things like pandemics, nuclear war, and AI. So I think that it's a legitimate movement to say, let's stop focusing so much on the immediate and look towards the future. Mm-hmm. And this is, and in some way, this is an unpopular and intuitive movement. So I might say, I have a lot of people who say the biggest crisis that we should focus on is the DEI movement, and who's, and is the Harvard president a plagiarist, and let's clean that all up and everything. And I think the long-termists might very correctly tell you, you're dealing with minutiae of the day. You should really be putting far more of your energies making sure AI is not going to kill us, making sure that next time COVID comes, we're ready for it, making sure that we're dealing with fertility crises and so on. And to me, that doesn't require any fancy math. That I think is just a good argument. Your part, though, does get into an area where it gets very weird. When people talk about, well, if all goes right, we could have a future which has a trillion, trillion, trillion add up. a trillion more, an enormous number of sentient beings, such that the number of people we have now is a tiny, tiny little mote in comparison. And then they would argue, if there's any chance that something could happen that would make it impossible to get to this paradise of so many happy, flourishing beings, it is of extreme importance.
Right.
And so then you get into something I would view as paradoxes. Paradoxes in the sense that there are conclusions that come from the arguments, but I don't want to accept them, and I don't think we should accept them, where if there's even a billion to one chance that what you're doing in this company, say, runs the risk of destroying that future, you have every right to kill everybody in the state.
I'm not that kind of long-termist.
Yeah, no, and I know you're not endorsing it.
And as it happens, I mean, a lot of the risks that long-termists are said to focus on are actually things to focus on even if you're a short-termist. Biotech is a perfect example. Pandemics, that's sometimes called like long-termist because, look, first of all, the truth is there's almost no such thing as an existential threat in the literal sense.
Yeah.
A few people would probably survive an all-out nuclear war.
Yeah.
A pandemic is very unlikely to kill every single person. And so on. And that's why I think that's one reason AI assumes so large. If you buy the Yudkowsky scenario, yes, it's going to kill us all. You know, that becomes a basis for doing that kind of math and thinking about the infinite souls that would be born and saying we should, you know, bomb chip factories to make sure AI is stopped in its tracks or something. Right.
And a long-termist make a huge distinction between killing 99% of us versus killing all of us. Because if you kill all of us, the game's over. There's no future.
Right.
There may be a future with other species, and some of them weren't thinking about that, other alien species, but we're done. But if some of us can survive, then we could flourish, maybe occupy other planets. And Will McCaskill says, look, occupying other planets is going to be such a huge thing. Because if you get colonies on different planets, all of a sudden human extinction becomes a lot less likely. We've diversified.
Right.
And I think Elon Musk believes that. And that doesn't seem crazy.
Well, all the crazy stuff, I think, does emanate from thinking about a threat where you're positing that it actually could wipe out everybody. Right.
If the threat is sufficiently unrealistic, it's crazy.
Well, no, but I mean also the implications that strike us as the extreme implications about what we might do in the present. Like the left-term critique of long-termism is that, it's for one thing, you quit thinking about the actual suffering of poor people and so on in the world right now, and you focus on the future. But just more broadly, the paradoxes you talk, what you call paradoxes, like the things that you might do today to reduce the chances of some distant risk a little, those emanate from thinking about a truly existential threat, right?
Yes. That involved bizarre math. I think it was Nicholas Bostrom who invented Pascal's mugging. And, you know, you're walking down the street and somebody comes up to you and says, give me $20. You say, no. He says, give me $20 or I will have this machine. He takes a stick out of his bag and I will wipe out the future of humanity.
If you don't give him the $20,
if you don't give him that, he's going to destroy all of humanity. And you think, well, the odds of him doing it are like as one in a trillion, 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 trillion. But if it's possible that maybe he is a god or an alien or something like that, you might as well give him the $20 because it's worth it for the gain that would be had by stopping humanity from being killed.
And I think
one way to take that is, well, that's really dumb. If you've gotten to a point where that becomes a rational decision, something got to give.
Yeah. Would that be tax deductible?
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, right?
Yes,
so I would do it because actually then it's like $13. Sure. That's a bargain.
You would do it for the tax break.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's true.
Let's see. How does this relate to things? You mentioned plagiarism, or did you? Well, you mentioned Harvard. There's an idea that you think is radical, or at least unpopular, that you're advancing. That I don't think is so radical and popular. No, but go ahead.
I've been writing a little bit about this, and this isn't an attempt at a segue, but. And I recommend people read Eric Hall, Hoel. He has a Substack, and he has some really smart things to say about the plagiarism case, which I agree with 100%. My very minor claim, which I think shouldn't be controversial, is that self-plagiarism isn't plagiarism. Self-plagiarism can be wrong for other reasons.
Context.
Yeah.
What's his name? Bill Ackman, who is largely responsible, I guess, for the Harvard professor Harvard president resigning, has a wife who was, I guess, Business Insider wrote a piece calling her a plagiarist after, you know, he helped unseat the Harvard president in part because she was a plagiarist.
Yeah.
And one of her sins, but not the only, was self-plagiarism. She also was apparently taking chunks of Wikipedia articles and acting as if she wrote them, but go ahead.
And now Ackman is put into the unusual position. First thing, it was, I think I could say this on your podcast, deeply shitty for Business Insider to go after the wife of somebody.
I don't know, but go ahead. I'll contest that later.
Okay,
she's not like at home darning socks. The woman was a professor at MIT, although not at this moment, who like gives TED Talks and shit. She's a public figure, okay? She's like, she's at least trying to be. If you've given a TED Talk, you're trying to be a public figure, okay? So I would just like to establish that much.
I still think she was targeted just because
she was. Of course she was. Life is hard.
It's one of the rules in The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Goodfellas as well. Maybe, presumably, the real mafia. Yeah. You don't go after family members.
And the Harvard president's plagiarism was uncovered because she was willing to let students say from the river to the sea. That seems weird, too. Life is not entirely fair, but go ahead.
Okay. So he gets upset. That makes plagiarism accusations against the Harvard president. This insight goes after his wife. He gets furious, says multiple things that are not entirely consistent. One is, taking from Wikipedia, maybe that's not really plagiarism. I look very closely at the codes and don't mention Wikipedia. And, you know, this is minor and so on. Everybody plagiarizes, which somehow undercuts his attack on Gay. But Everybody. And then the next stage is he is planning, and I assume this is still in the works, to analyze the output of everybody at MIT and later on all Ivy League universities to unmask all of their plagiarism.
Excellent. Bring it on.
Upon, they will all be fired.
Good.
I just frantically have to get my name off the Yale website.
You really should, because I have suspicions about your research technique.
Well, I have suspicions too. I mean, because I've written a lot. I recently check with plagiarism checkers when I write a book. Mm-hmm. Highly recommended, so I don't do something by accident. Can I say I've never accidentally lifted a sentence or some good lines? I don't know. People make mistakes.
Is it that you don't know or that you don't want to say? Is there something you'd like to get off your chest?
No, I honestly know I have never in my life
intentionally
plagiarized. I also know that for a long time I've taken great pains not to avoid inadvertent plagiarism. Mm-hmm. So I don't have research assistants, unlike some of my friends, do my work. Everything's me. Do I know I've never plagiarized in a very strict definition? I don't. It's possible. I'm looking at a paper. I'm writing out the results, and some of those words just kind of pop up on my page.
Mm-hmm.
And my own view is this happens all the time, and it's for the most part harmless. And if there's a bit too much of it, you owe somebody an apology, and you say you don't do it again. You try to be more careful. I think there's serious plagiarism where people intentionally steal other people's ideas.
Actually, idea theft happens all the time. It's not illegal. I mean, plagiarism isn't illegal, but it's like a formally defined norm violation and prohibited by certain institutions. Idea theft happens all the time. I got stories for you, man.
We all do.
We all do. I've been victim. Have I told you about how often I've been victimized in so many ways? I've also been, have you ever been a victim of plagiarism? You ever been plagiarized?
Yes.
Who was it?
Once I've noticed and I just went, eh. And another time, this is an odd form of plagiarism. Tell me if this is plagiarism.
Mm-hmm.
I have online courses where I give lectures. My Yale courses, I have PowerPoints and something like that. Somebody said, and in some country, someplace, some professor, I'll not say who it is, said, my professor is standing up and giving lectures that are your lectures.
The whole lecture?
Word for word, verbatim from what you said.
Oh, come on.
With your slides and
that. You should blow the whistle.
I think I blew the whistle-ish. I think I sent somebody an email.
That's blowing the whistle.
Another person told me, this is not smart, that there's a professor who gives TED Talks. He stands up and gives these amazing TED Talks that were not his own. He has the transcripts in front of him. He uses the slides.
Well, I hope he doesn't give one given by Bill Ackman's wife, because that could turn out to have plagiarism in it. And somebody could go, wait, I thought I heard that in Wikipedia, and he gets nailed.
But point being, there's a lot of plagiarism around. I think most good people try to avoid it. I think when it does happen, it's inadvertent. I think it's wrong. And they should be corrected. You don't want to take credit for other people's work. But it's not the horrible scourge that some people have. And the real problems of stealing of ideas, it seems far more serious, but it's not the sort of thing you're going to get from an AI algorithm. And also,
no, and it's not something you can very easily police.
Right.
Except in, there are cases in especially the hard sciences, I guess, where there could even be documentation.
How many times in your career has somebody come up to you and said, well, you say, we have a non-zero relationship. Your theory of the evolution of God goes like this. Haven't you read my book? You must have read my book 30 years before, and it says exactly the same thing.
With non-zero, that happened. There was some guy who wrote a book about synergy. It was called Synergy or something. And, synergy is a non-zero, it's a positive sum version of a non-zero sum relationship. Yeah, he was right. But no, I had never heard of his book. I mean, I didn't.
Yeah.
But he was upset. He was super upset.
Yeah. Yeah. I got something I don't want to talk about that much, but a noted scientist claimed we stole one of his ideas in a paper that we did very well and made formal complaints. Mm. One of the reasons why it didn't get any further is that the idea was in an unpublished manuscript that none of us has ever read. Well, we could have got the gist of it somehow.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing is, I think he was wrong, but I don't know where my ideas come from. I go to a lot of conferences. If you tell me something really cool over a bar a year ago, and then I'm mulling it over with my graduate students, they say, hey, you know, what if we did it like this?
Yeah.
How sure am I? I mean, it's not impossible. It's your idea.
That's why idea theft is hard to police. It's an amorphous thing. And also we all, you know, it's well documented that, you know, people think they deserve more credit than they deserve. There's a joke. Darwin makes a joke in a letter where he says somebody's appearance was so altered. Maybe it was his after the thing on the Beagle, but that even his even people who had lent money to him wouldn't remember him. The point being, you know, you keep closer track of people who are indebted to you than you do of your own debts.
Yes, that's right.
And that's actually a human tendency. So I forgive all the people who have stolen my ideas.
All that you need is for them to forgive you.
For what? I've forgotten. That's the part I don't remember.
What could I have been talking about?
That's the part I don't remember is when I, of course, the ideas of theirs I stole.
And the other thing I want to say is that self-plagiarism is just bullshit. There's no such thing as self-plagiarism.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I have traditionally not done it, but I've been more and more inclined. I mean, John McPhee says, look, if I've written something once, if I've described something one way, it's because I thought it was the best possible way to describe it. Okay, I'm not going to create an inferior version of that. I mean, I don't know. I don't think he cuts and pastes much from old work, but he was just saying as a matter of principle, it's kind of ridiculous to change a few words so it doesn't look like you plagiarized yourself.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Have you paid much attention to the Dan Ariely case, which is an allegation of data fabrication? But
yeah. Yeah, he's one of the most prominent cases. There's Dan's case, more than one. And Francesca Gino also has some serious
cases. Those are, to some extent, the same case. They collaborated on something.
They collaborated. There's cases of separate accusations of fraud, one by him, one by her, with the same paper, different experiments in the same paper.
My understanding is true.
All of this is under investigation.
Yeah.
One facet of it, which I found kind of ugly, is Francesca Gino sued Yale, which I believe is every bit her right. And she sued Yale by saying that the procedures that may end up with her losing her job or losing tenure have not been carried through properly. They were carried through in a biased way. I don't know the facts, but, you know, sure, sue Yale. But she also sued for a lot of money, Data Collada, which are the sort of unpaid scientists who investigate data fraud.
Right.
And Data Collada were very clear, sort of, here's all our evidence, here's what we think, this is all in good faith, and so on. And it's not clear how the suit's going to go through. A lot of the field stepped up and gave Data Collada an enormous amount of money to support their legal costs. It's extremely expensive to get sued. But if she won, it would basically put any sort of whistleblowers, data police, data analyzers out of work.
Yeah.
Because if I'm going to criticize your study, and then you say to me, I'm suing you now. Nobody wants to be sued.
Right. Yeah.
So that's one thing. That's
that seems,
people are looking at that very tightly.
Seems like a bridge too far. You know, Dan Ariely, as he has noted, the irony is a lot of the work he's done is on dishonesty and how unconsciously dishonest people are. And so, of course, he denies that he did any of this. The research in question was the finding that if you make people sign at the top of a document rather than the bottom, they're less likely to lie in the course of filling it out.
Yeah.
And it was consequential. The government, like, re-engineered documents, the U.S. government. But anyway, you know, I had him on my podcast, and I also met him once in Mexico at Ciudad de los Ideas.
All the cool kids go. I've had some fun there on my own.
I really liked him. Also, he was on my side. I mean, he wasn't literally on my side, but after I had this debate with the new atheist with Sam Harris and the late Chris Hitchens, there was a point I made that he said he agreed with. And no better way to endear yourself to me than that. I really liked him. And who knows, jury, you know, I await final resolution of this issue. So we're close
Dan,
to the
Dan, Dan by yeah. the way, is there's a lot of accusations against him. Mm. And I think like a lot of people feel I'm agnostic. And I wish I could dismiss them as obviously frivolous and unfounded, but I can't. They're pretty serious.
On other papers too.
And
such a shame. I mean, we should also say he's had a tough life. He was very, very badly burned in very early adulthood. I think still it causes him pain. When he did the podcast with me, he was sitting in a hammock, I think because it minimized surface contact between his skin and other things.
I guess I would also add two things. One thing is that he is, at least to me and people I know, extremely decent guy.
Yeah.
Funny, energetic, but also I noticed there's been some students who were floundering and he helped provide them money, provide them assistance and everything. And he has a clump of people who really adore him, take him as a hero. And so he's not an asshole. He's not somebody sort of self-centeredly, you know, gaining on. He's not a Dietrich Stoppel type. And then the second thing is he has a TV show based on him. I forget what it's called. It's on NBC or something. A while ago, there was a show called Lie to Me based on Ekman's work on emotion detection. And this is similar.
This is Ekman, like, Ekman, not Ekman.
That's right. It's called, I think, The Irrationalist. And that's
based on Ariely, right? There's a professor in that that's based on Ariely.
Yes. The guy has burns. The guy drives a fast car. He's very Ariely-esque. And he comes in. And for those crimes, which a keen eye towards irrationality can help you solve the crimes.
I see.
He stepped in for that.
I see. So, Paul, as you know, at some point we bring down the paywall. I mean, not to put this too crassly, but after that, we're in overtime and paid subscribers to... Wait, we're doing this your newsletter too, or do you wait some future date when we start doing that? I mean, paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter can have access. And what about, is there a mechanism for paid subscribers to the falsely modest Small Potatoes newsletter to do it?
I was going to ask you that once I moved to paid, could I get access to these full things? And
have you moved to paid?
Yeah.
Yeah, we can do this. We can show you how to do it.
That'd be looking forward to that. That'd be good.
So to listen to the rest of this, you should become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero newsletter, although you could in principle become a paid subscriber to the falsely modest Small Potatoes newsletter. But you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that. You could, but you shouldn't. You should become a paid subscriber to my newsletter. Right?
Yeah. At this point, yes.
Yeah.
Later we'll discuss revenue sharing and get the lawyers into it.
The rev share just magically happens.
You just set up.
You trust me. What was I going to say? But actually, no. They can become paid subscribers. I mean, we'll, it's easy. We'll do, have you ever done a podcast on the Substack platform?
No.
Okay. Do you want this to be your first one? We can help.
Okay, not help, but we'll do it.
We will do it.
Okay.
All right, we can help. Put it up. We'll introduce you. Okay. To the really mysteries of posting a podcast. And the way people will know if we've succeeded, like, is if they go to your site and they see this as a post, and you know, then that means we've done it. If they don't see it, we haven't done it yet, and they can't get access that way, but we'll do it. And then the way it works is they can then set up a whole special podcast feed to paid subscribers to either newsletter. And then they will get access to all the paid podcast content from, I should be clear. If you want the paid access to all of the Non-Zero podcasts, you have to become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero. But you may become a prolific podcaster. under the tutelage of people like me and the, very suboptimal coaching of very bad wizards.
It's possible. It's possible. Mm-hmm. Right now it's all free. It's all free. Every bit's free.
Oh, wait. Is it? Wait. Let's be clear. Is your newspaper all free?
All free. I have no paid tier.
You're not going paid? You haven't gone paid yet?
I'm going to go paid sometime in the future, but right now, not.
Okay, so we haven't done it. It won't be this podcast, folks. I'm glad we got that cleared up.
Okay.
But the next, we'll do this within a month, and you'll be set up by then. It'll be great.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're going to now go into overtime and talk. There's a bunch of stuff we thought we might talk about, haven't talked about. You co-authored a paper for an actual serious journal called In Praise of Empathic AI. You've already written a book called Against Empathy. So apparently you love empathy when machines do it, hate it when humans do it.
Exactly.
We'll have you try to wrestle yourself out of that self-inflicted mess. At any time you can ask me about the JFK assassination, I'll be happy to help. I've gone down that road.
I've noticed that. Yeah.
I do want to get into the Substack thing at least a little more. My actual position on the issue. I'm not leaving the Substack platform. You're not leaving it. Yeah. But I want to explore that a little more. I mean, I want to quickly say, well, there was something a little weird about Casey Newton's like rationale for leaving, and I want to get into that. I like his newsletter a lot. He's great. He's smart. Mm-hmm. Writes about social media. But I heard him talk about this on this podcast, and it seemed kind of weird. But I'll talk about that in overtime. Mentioned rationalists. Yeah, if we have time. I keep promising to critique the Nick Bostrom simulation kind of argument.
No, you did.
Yeah, but I'm still slightly mischaracterized it. I want to talk a little about that, although I still think it's vulnerable to something or other.
Also, I have some career advice I need from you.
Oh, I was hoping you had some for me. I'd be happy to help if you reciprocate. I think,
what a thing to say. Is that where the non-zero spirit comes from, if you reciprocate?
I'm very transactional, yeah.
It's fine to be trying that. You're just not supposed to be so blunt about it.
That's the whole thing about human nature.
A friend asks you, can you do me a favor? He's like, yes, and you will do me one in the future later.
Isn't that what friendship is? Contracts?
You're
contractual
not
relationship?
To say that.
Oh. Well, that explains why I don't have any friends. Yeah. Well, now you tell me. Where were you when I needed you? I could have a lot of friends by now if I'd known this. Okay, so, and wait, is there anything? There may be... I do think, related to this is we should share like productivity tips and things like career related things like that. Yeah. Maybe is our niche. How do we become as famous and successful as you? That could be the thing.
How can everyone
become small potatoes? That's kind of the thing.
I asked you two podcasts ago to describe your sort of writing routine. Mm-hmm. You almost comically refused to do it.
I'm opening up to that.
He would say things like, I do write. And then I said, well, tell me more. And you'd say, I answered your question. What more is there to say?
There is more to say, but it's in overtime. So this week, at least, the only way to hear it is become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter. Plus, it's a worthy cause compared to some causes, right?
My newest Substack, we could talk about this, is going to be, it's coming out next week, is going to be 3 productivity tips.
Right. Okay.
I like giving advice. I don't want to get audience captured to giving advice all the time. I like also write like thing about the experience machine or AI, or
right,
showing and sharing and everything. But I like giving advice.
Good. And yet you're going to seek my advice in overtime. But yes. That's fine. Finally, I'd say in encouraging people to become paid subscribers to newsletters, I'm not one of the Nazis on Substack. And actually, Substack kicked a lot of the Nazis off, by the way. That's the weird thing about what Casey Newton did. But we'll get into that.
Not even Nazi adjacent.
No. Some of my best friends aren't Nazis. I want to be clear about that. Okay.
And that's the worry about these censorship drives, which they go after the people everybody hates. Mm-hmm. But then they take a look at you, and maybe some people don't like the views you have about Ukraine.
This is an established fact, by the way.
This is the worry.
Yeah. Yeah. I should not be. People should not lump me in with Nazis, right?
They should not, but they may do. And then you have to ask the question: how much do you trust the people making these decisions?
Right. We will answer all these questions in overtime. To listen, just Google Non-Zero and Substackers and become a paid subscriber. Or whatever. And we will see you in overtime. Okay. First, thank you to everybody, even if you're not going in overtime. Now we're going in overtime.